The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Canada, you it live from the second, as we Americans like to say, aggrandizement. Not really. I am in Paris with Generalissimo himself, producing the show from the left bank. Ed Morrissey is in Texas, co-hosting with us in the event that the Latin Quarter collapses its internet. Edward, good morning. Good to see you again in Texas.
Good morning, sir. And I'm from the heart of Texas, arrondissement, I think is.
We call it the aggrandizement here. That's what we do here. And it's after last night's four mile bus ride from the hotel to the restaurant. I'm now convinced that Bill de Blasio is the mayor of Paris. They have filled in the middle of all the streets in Paris and allow bicyclers to roam everywhere wildly. I've never been close to being carsick in my life. I'm 66 years old. But last night, the bus in Paris, never get on a bus in Paris. That's a what do they say Dennis Farina says in Snatch?
Oh, in Snatch,
Don't go to England.
Don't go to England.
Okay, so I got this to declare. Don't get on a bus in Paris. That's what I got to declare. Edward, let's do the rundown for people so it's a somewhat normal show. New York Times, U.S. officials are anxiously watching the French presidential election, aware that the outcome on Sunday could scramble President Biden's relation with Europe and reveal dangerous fissures in Western democracy. That's just a bit alarmist. The tour guide told me it's 55-45 Macron. What do you think, Ed?
I think probably true. Now, with the caveat that all politics are local, even in France, but I think Macron has really established himself as a leader in Europe over this Ukraine crisis in a way that Olaf Scholz has not. Boris Johnson has as well. But I think if you're looking at the West, in Europe at least, the two leaders really are Johnson and Macron. And I think even though the French voters might have some issues with Macron, I don't think they change horses in the middle of this particular stream.
I don't either. We're going to come to Boris in a second. Times of Israel from AP, quote, satellite images released yesterday showed what appeared to be mass graves near Mariupol. And local officials accused Russia of burying up to 9,000 Ukrainian civilians there in an effort to conceal the slaughter taking place in the siege of the port city. That's actually one of the most awful headlines I've ever read on the air live, Edward. Do you think they're capable of that?
The Russians? Absolutely, they're capable of it. I mean, if you've seen what happened in Chechnya 20 years ago, I think you know that this is actually this is a Russian's standard operational procedure. The way that they've conducted war in Syria is exactly the same way. This is who the Russians are. And I think that we have really lost sight over the last 30 years of Russian elite leadership and what it is and what their history is. The post-Soviet era is really still just Russian imperialism in a different flavor. Now that they have resources to pursue it, they're pursuing it. And I think that people just really lost the thread of this.
I believe it, the world will have to be, I couldn't buy a barrel of gas anywhere or a barrel of oil from Russia anywhere if this turns out to be true. It's already that way to me. I just think it's so disgusting. Well, that
I agree, but here's the thing. I mean, we're buying stuff from China, and they're committing an outright genocide in Xinjiang.
Right.
I mean,
but we don't see it. The difference is Americans don't see it.
Yes.
And if you don't see it, it doesn't happen in America. Financial Times, Elon Musk has unveiled a $46.5 billion financing package to fund his takeover bid for Twitter as he pushes forward with the deal. Do you think this is coming off, or is this Elon Musk just generating Elon Musk's headlines?
No. I think the fact that he's lining up financing with Morgan Stanley says he's extremely serious about this. I think the board was hoping that he was just being, you know, Musk being Musk and doing things for a few headlines. If you're lining up $25 billion, $26 billion of financing with Morgan Stanley, you're serious about this. He's putting his Tesla stock up as collateral on this.
It's amazing. Also from the Financial Times, Jay Powell has sent his strongest signal yet that the Federal Reserve is preparing to raise interest rates by a half percentage point at least at its next meeting. I believe that's foregone. It's baked into the cake. I don't think it'll bother the markets. What do you think, Edward Morrissey?
Same thing, and I think that they're expecting a lot more than that. The monetary supply here has been way too loose for way too long, and they're going to try to tighten it up right now. The problem is that Federal Reserve is really the only game in town because Congress will not adopt fiscal discipline. They will not stop spending money, and that forces monetary expansions all on its own. So the Fed is the only game in town, and they're going to have to start playing.
All right. The Telegraph, the great paper of Great Britain. Boris Johnson put his political future in the hands of a star chamber of MPs. For the benefit of the Steelers fans, that means a secret proceeding. As he insisted he had nothing to hide, the prime minister on Tuesday forced to accept a parliamentary investigation into whether he had lied to the Commons. Now, in the United States, people lie all the time on the floor of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and there is no rebuke. But if you're a minister and you lie to the House, it's considered you got to quit. What do you think, Edward? What's your odds on Boris surviving? For a while there, I thought he was invincible.
I mean, my first thing is, what's it called when a president misleads Congress in the United States? It's called Wednesday. But the prime minister is appointed by Parliament and is responsible to Parliament in a way that's not true in the United States. And so, yes, I mean, there's a reason for that. I think it would be difficult to change horses in the middle of this Ukraine crisis, especially with Boris Johnson performing so well in it. But I also think that their tradition dictates that if you're getting your power from Parliament and you try to mislead Parliament, you're pretty much gone. And that's a fairly reliable outcome in those cases.
If they lose this red wall by-election that's coming up, an election in a seat that went from Liberal to Tory in the north of England, they have a red wall by-election because one of the Tories turned out to be a child molester, I think. I think that was what the charge was. Every other Tory is going to put, they're going to go full Julius Caesar with Brutus as his best friend on the way to the forum on Boris Johnson because they don't want to get wiped out. A moment of silence, please, Ed. I know this hurts a great deal. Wall Street Journal. CNN is shutting its streaming service, CNN Plus, after a month. $300 million in startup costs, between $100 and $200 million in promotion, 110,000 subscribers, and they just did the new Coke thing. We have a new Coke. It's called CNN Plus. It's a shorthand for every kind of fiasco you could possibly imagine. And I put my whole view, there are bad takes, there are good takes on this. Here's my take, Ed. No one's going to pay for slow news. And everything is slow compared to print. If you want news, you go to, I've got 10 subscriptions to newspapers, magazines, because I can read them as fast as we're doing. And we're fast. We're doing like 10 stories in 10 minutes. It could never have worked. It's not the talent. It just could not work.
No, it's a bad idea. It's just a completely unworkable idea. And if you want the hard news, you actually tune into CNN, which if you're a cable subscriber, you've already got. So why are you paying for soft news from CNN that is really basically you're paying for content that's not interesting enough to go on CNN's air?
It's this the original blue no bubble. It's the original blue bubble. They talked to each other into doing this. Florida lawmakers from the Wall Street Journal gave final approval to a bill that would end a special tax district that allows Walt Disney to govern land housing its theme parks. Okay, I got a call from a friend, a text. Are you in favor of the Don't Say Gay bill? And I wrote back and said, well, it's probably unconstitutional on a content viewpoint neutrality basis. But if Disney wants to get in the boxing ring with state government, expect to get punched. What do you think, Ed? A, on the constitutionality and whether or not you would have voted for it if you're in the Florida legislature.
The constitutionality of the rescission of the special districts?
No, of the Don't Say Gay law, which isn't a Don't Say Gay law. It's not
a Don't Say Gay law. This is a bill that sets standards for school curricula on sex education. That's not unconstitutional. I mean, this is part of the state and local school board authority.
It will be unconstitutional. It will be unconstitutional if they say it's okay to teach this curriculum about sex ed, but not this curriculum about sex ed. But by banning all of the curriculum, it's content new. I think I haven't read the law. Have you read the law?
Yes, I've read the law. It was a while back. It was when they first put it up for a vote. I read the law, and the issue is that you can't talk about certain types of, you can't talk about gender ideology, you can't talk about sexual orientation in sex education classes from K to 3. After that, it has to be age appropriate. So it isn't actually this curriculum's okay, that curriculum is not. It's just that those topics are not to be discussed.
Well, that is
K
content neutral and viewpoint neutral, so it will be constitutional. Yeah. I just haven't read it, but I said I if Disney gets in the ring and they get punched in the face. We have 1 minute, two more stories. 4 days after Philly became the first American city to reinstate the mask mandate, it's been revoked. And in the New York Times, the outcome in New York will have significant implications. They lost a redistricting case yesterday. New York State's intermediate appeals court struck down their redistricting map. I am perfectly confident the New York highest court is going to put it back. But I also am so glad that Philly screwed up the mask mandate so that everyone can say, what do you got to declare? Don't go to Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think what really I wrote about this morning, I think what really killed it was John Fetterman saying that he was against it right before they went into that debate. And I think that the Philadelphia said, this must be pretty darn unpopular.
Ed Morrissey is with me from Texas. I and Radio Blogger are in Paris. We're not wearing berets. We're not using the bad French accent because we're not punch drunk from jet lag today. And we will be right back after the break on the Friday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Suffisait de te parler pour t'apprivoiser.
Welcome back, America. Say goodbye to Hollywood, even on streaming platforms. I'm Hugh Hewitt from Paris with Radio Blogger. Along with me, Ed Morrissey is in Texas, and we're joined by the official film critic of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Sonny Punch. Hello, Sonny. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. How are you?
Well, you're in the doghouse with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt for Everything Everywhere All at Once, but that's not what we're going to talk about. That's when I get back into the country. I got to ask you what you think of the Netflix implosion. Much, you know, the CNN Plus implosion, I understand completely, but the Netflix dropping by whatever it dropped, what did you make of that, Sonny?
Yeah, CNN Plus is interesting because I was never entirely sure who the audience for CNN Plus was. CNN Plus, if they had offered the actual streaming version of CNN, that would be more valuable than the kind of series of soft, newsy, personality-driven stuff that they were offering. I just didn't get it. So the fall of CNN Plus was not a huge shock to me, and I feel bad because I like people at CNN. I've got friends there. You know, that's unfortunate, but, you know, whatever. Netflix is another interesting case. So Netflix, if folks don't know, Netflix, the stock dropped, I don't know, I think a quarter of its value over the last week. They shed subscribers for the first time in a decade or so. You know, they lost subscribers. Which is not what you want to be doing if your stock is, you know, valued essentially on being the last service standing, because that is what Wall Street has kind of predicted for Netflix since the rise of streaming and the move to a post-cable future. There were some folks who thought, well, Netflix is going to be there's only going to be one service. It's going to be Netflix. Now, this was always kind of foolish. Never made much sense to me. But the thing about Netflix is that unlike some of these big tech companies and unlike some of these, big entertainment companies, it made tons and tons of money. It makes tons and tons of money. I mean, it actually generates a great, great, enormous amount of revenue because it still has 200 million subscribers, right? It generates something like $18 billion a year in revenue just from their subscription service. That's a lot of money. That's more than the domestic box office back before COVID, right? That's more than the entire domestic U.S. box office. So, you know, Netflix is a weird case in that they were overvalued despite the fact that they actually still earned a ton of money. Now, what happens to the company from here is really kind of up in the air, because Netflix has some structural problems. Netflix's biggest problem was its initial selling point, right? The initial selling point of Netflix streaming was, hey, we're doing the binge model. You get Netflix and you get a season of House of Cards and it comes out in 1 week, and the whole week, it's all there. The whole season is there. You watch it all. You watch a whole season of Stranger Things in a weekend, right? And that was an actual legitimate innovation. It changed how people watch TV. It changed kind of what they expected. There are still folks who get frustrated with week-to-week rollouts on some of the other streaming platforms like Disney Plus. But it's a bad model. It's a bad model because it's extremely expensive. On the one hand, you have to put out tons and tons more content. If you're doing a whole season of television a week and you're putting out, you know, essentially a new season every 2 weeks, that's a problem. You just can't, you can't keep that sort of pace up. But worse than that, I think, is the way it kills buzz so quickly. So, you know, I mean, people talk about Netflix shows for a week, and then they move on to the next thing because everybody who really wants to watch it all watches it all. And then, you know, everybody else is kind of falling behind and they don't talk about it as much. It's just a bad model.
And you walk around not wanting to do a spoiler, Ed.
Right, right. And Sunny, hi, this is Ed Morrissey. Great to talk with you. I was struck by the fact that Netflix is actually one of the better quality original programming platforms, too. And so they do have quite a bit of really good original content. Amazon has some. But about the model that you're talking about, I'm a subscriber to Discovery Plus because I'm hooked on HGTV. I mean, it's just I'm an addict. And they are very much the opposite. It's a 1 week, one show a week rollout. Even if you're a paid subscriber, you get about a 24-hour early view of whatever the latest episode is of your favorite shows. And to me, that does make a lot more sense. Is Netflix going to restructure in that way? And the second question I have for you is, will this loss of capital impact their ability to create new and original programming?
Well, so to answer the first part first, I think that they are already starting to move away from this model a little bit. If you look at what is happening with the last season of Ozark, for instance, so the next season of Ozark, their hit show is the last season, and they're rolling it out in two parts. You know, there's part one is coming 1 month, part two is coming the next month. That they're doing that on purpose to force folks to stick around for 2 months, right, instead of, you know, just signing up for 1 month and then dropping it once they're done binging the new season of Ozark. And they're doing the same thing with the new season of Stranger Things. New season of Stranger Things is coming in two parts. So I think they are coming to terms with the fact that the binging model is not necessarily the best way to go about it, at least from a business point of view. Because again, what happens is, you know, people sign up when there's a show that they want to watch and they sign up for a month and then they drop the service. This is what we call churn in the industry. And it is, you know, it's a problem for all streaming services, but I think it's a particular problem for Netflix, in the sense that, again, they make it very easy to sign up for a month and then get rid of it, for 3 or 4 months until you're ready for the next thing. In terms of will they be able to keep making the original content, I mean, the fascinating thing about Netflix, again, it's a company that makes, it generates a ton of money, $18, $20, $21 billion, some enormous amount of money. And they are still spending more than that because they are creating so much content, because it's not just American shows, right? They're making shows in every country where they are. This is why you get something like Squid Game, right? Squid Game is a Korean show. It was relatively cheap to make. I think it cost like $20 million to produce or something like that. It became an enormous worldwide hit. That is Netflix's holy grail. They want that sort of show, the show that costs $20 million to make, that gets watched in every territory by tons and tons of people. The problem is that those shows are very few and far between. American audiences don't like subtitled programs, and America is still the largest audience. So they have a problem. And again, all of this original content was funded on essentially venture capital. People were pouring money into Netflix. They were accumulating debt at a huge, enormous, massive rate, and they're not going to be able to keep doing that, I don't think. If their market cap I was looking at the stock today. Their value has declined by something like 60% over the last year. It's crazy. They've lost an enormous amount of market capitalization. And so the big criticism, right, is, well, Netflix should have, when it had the market cap, Netflix should have bought MGM or Netflix should have, you know, should have tried to buy Sony, because I think Sony is still kind of quietly on the market right now, Sony Pictures, or Lionsgate. You know, they should have bought somebody with a big library that has some IP that they can, you know, use to bolster the Netflix stable. And they didn't do that, and now they're not going to be able to do that. So they're going to.
So, Sonny, I've got to ask you a quick question, get a quick review from you as well, and make a comment. My comment is that they're going to figure out that all these streaming services have got to start streaming people like Victor Davis Hanson doing his podcast, because there are audiences for that, and he only does two a week. Number two, if you were going to have one streaming service, Sonny Bunch was going to have one streaming service, which one would it be? And then, since I see Nicolas Cage movie in French all over the French buses, what do you think of that movie? Go ahead, Sonny. We got like 2 minutes.
If I could only have one streaming service, it would be HBO Max. HBO Max has the deepest library and the best originals. You know, Ed mentioned that Netflix has lots of originals. They do have lots of originals. They make a ton of original shows. The problem is none of them are really must-watch for me. I mean, right now I'm watching on HBO Max, I'm watching Winning Time and Tokyo Vice, two new shows. But there are probably half a dozen other HBO Max originals that I've watched and enjoyed. I can't remember the last time I watched a Netflix original series.
I thought you were going to say Amazon, because Amazon also lets you buy stuff. So Amazon's got a second reason to subscribe.
Well, Prime Video, yeah, Prime Video has a big advantage in that it gives you access to more movies because it lets you subscribe to things. I mean, it's really more of Amazon Prime Video is really more of a traditional VOD pay-per-view service, right? That's how I like to think of Amazon Prime. And they do have some good originals. I mean, I can't remember if we talked about it, but they've got a new one with Chris Pine called All the Old Knives.
I haven't watched it yet. I did like, you know, Jack Ryan's over there, so I watched Jack Ryan. We got a minute, Sonny. Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
So I actually haven't seen The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent yet. I hear good things. It's 90% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. People seem very excited about it. But the premise here is Nicolas Cage plays an actor called Nick Cage, who is essentially broke, just like the real Nick Cage. And he is offered $1 million to come hang out with a international criminal played by Pedro Pascal. It becomes sort of a buddy comedy and also a meta comedy about Nicolas Cage and the state of his career and how that is all going. Again, I didn't see. I actually saw The Northman, the new Viking.
Oh, you got 30 seconds. What do you think about The Northman?
Well, The Northman is basically Conan the Barbarian, but an art house version of that set in Norway in the. Yeah, I think it's 970 AD, something like that. It's very, very violent. It's a little bit weird. Again, it is kind of an art housey type movie. Lots of visions and you know, nightmares and terrors and that sort of thing. I don't know if you're going to like it. It's a little bit. It's very, very violent. Very, very bloody.
I like swords.
Word of warning.
I like swords and axes. And I watched The Last Kingdom and all that stuff. I like Bernard Cornwell. Ed, are you going to watch that one, The Northman?
I think so. It's up my alley, absolutely.
It's got swords, right?
It's got swords. What else can you say?
Sonny Bunch, you can get his podcast, Sonny, across the movie aisle, and The Bulwark Goes to the Movie. Sonny Bunch, thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. Don't go anywhere, America. Who's next? Tom Weiler? I think so, from Minnesota, the next congressman from Minnesota's 3rd Congressional District. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live in Paris with Generalissimo Ed Morrissey standing by in Texas. But I am joined by Tom Weiler. And if I was in Minnesota tomorrow, I would second the nomination of Tom Weiler to be the next congressman from the 3rd Congressional District. And if I can do it from Paris, here it is. I second the nomination of Tom Weiler. He was my neighbor in Virginia when he was serving in the submarine service in the Pentagon. I got to know him very well. He's a great American. He is now retired from the Navy, and he is going to be a great congressman. Tom, welcome. Good luck tomorrow in the Minnesota State Convention. And you Minnesota conventioneers, nominate Tom, because we got to win that 3rd Congressional District. How's it look, Tom?
It looks very well, Hugh. And first off, good morning to you and good morning to all your listeners. And thank you very much for the second. I really appreciate it.
Well, tell me how it works. Most of us who don't live in Minnesota don't have any idea what the process is like. Ed was briefing me on it at the beginning, and it sounds incoherent and crazy to me. But I love everyone in the room. They come to all my events when I'm in Minnesota. So I love you. Make sure you nominate Tom Weiler.
Well, sir, first off, it will be 70 degrees here tomorrow, so it's not so cold tomorrow. This is our first 70-degree day, though, of the spring. But, yeah, how the convention works is there's been about 250 delegates who first went to a caucus night on February 1st, then were elected by their peers, basically, at a BPOU convention. So that's a basic political organizing unit, of course. And those delegates have moved on now to the 3rd Congressional District Republican Convention. And I hope to get 60% of their votes or more, and that will be the official endorsement of the Minnesota GOP to support my campaign to defeat Congressman Dean Phillips on November 8th.
Now, I'm very excited about this because I think the 3rd District is going to be competitive, and I know a submariner is needed in the Congress. We need someone who actually knows Virginia class, Ohio class, and the future Columbia class. Is that going over well? Is that message that national security matters to Minnesota Coldians working?
Absolutely. I think there's a clear differentiation between myself serving 20 years in the submarine force and some unique experiences both at the Pentagon, like you said, working in offices that help fund and determine the requirements and resourcing for the submarine force, as well as experience I had working as a legislative defense fellow on Capitol Hill, and my overall knowledge of foreign policy operating against Chinese and Russian forces for the last 20 years, and that differentiates very well with Congressman Dean Phillips, who's been in Congress for 4 years now, has voted 100% with Speaker Pelosi in the last session, and doesn't really have any foreign policy or international experience.
Tom, do the folks in your district get, and Minnesota voters are pretty smart, so I suspect that they get this, that the future of deterrence depends upon our underwater capacity. I don't think we have a submariner in Congress, and we certainly don't have anyone who recently retired after 20-plus years, both on boomers and attack subs. I just don't think we've got the necessary. We got great Republicans like Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, Tom Cotton in the Senate. We got a lot of people with military experience. I just don't think we have anyone from the Silent Service.
I think you're correct on that, Hugh. And yeah, I do think the future of both strategic deterrence and the future in the Western Pacific as well, specifically any China-Taiwan scenario, submarines are a huge factor in that. And obviously, PACOM commanders for the past decade or so have made the point, regardless of if they're aviators, surface warriors, or submariners, that buying a new Virginia class is about the best investment the Department of Defense can make to make us more secure against Russia, China, and all of our foes in the future.
Now, Tom, when I go up to Minnesota, people still want to talk about farm policy. They still want to talk about the Minnesota State Fair, and they still want to talk about crime in Minneapolis and in probably your district. What has dominated the campaigning thus far, and which I'm sure will be on the minds of everyone at the state convention?
Absolutely. It is clearly public safety still. Unfortunately, Minnesota became an epicenter of the defund the police movement with the riots of 2020. And that was really a motivating factor for me to get into the race. If my diagnosis with Parkinson's prematurely into my submarine career. And so I came back inspired to hopefully provide more conservative leadership to D.C. and to represent the folks in the 3rd District in a more positive, conservative manner than Congressman Dean Phillips. And, yeah, so it's definitely public safety. And then that 8% inflation, that hits every Minnesotan just like it hits every American right in the face every morning when they're putting food on the table and filling up their gas tanks to go to work. And then the third issue really is education. And both crime and education clearly don't need to be solved from D.C., those are much better solved at the local level, but there's still an element of support and making sure states and localities have the proper resources. And that's what I hope to do as a congressman.
You know, this is Ed Morrissey, and I'm a recent departee of Minnesota. I know the third district pretty well. And I'm curious as to how much impact the outward migration from the Minneapolis and St. Paul core into the third district is going to play in the election here. What the impact of that
30
is going
seconds,
to be.
Tom Weiler. 30 seconds.
Yes, sir. Yeah, there's been a shift in the demographic shift in the third district, but it's somewhat slight, honestly. The districts were redrawn as well. So really, overall, this has been a conservative district for about 30 of the last 34 years, and those conservative roots still run very deep in Minnesota's third. So I think
good luck in the convention tomorrow. Good luck in the convention tomorrow, Tom Weiler. I'm proud to second your nomination. I hope you get many other seconds to your nomination. I hope you get nominated, and I hope you go forward to the Congress, and I'll see you back in D.C. when you win. Go nowhere, America. As former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo joins Ed Morrissey and I in hour two of today's Friday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Kennedy Hewitt, live from Paris, where Radio Blogger is. I'm joined also by Ed Morrissey, who is in Texas, making sure that if the Latin Quarter's internet goes down, we are not stranded. And I'm joined by my old friend, former Oklahoma Attorney General, former Director Administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and now candidate for the retiring Jim Inhofe's Senate seat, Scott Pruitt. Scott, welcome back, General. It's great to have you back on the show.
Bonjour. And I'm sure Ed's in a far better place in Texas, right?
He is. He's in a far better place. But I think it's interesting that I'm talking to you from Paris because you are responsible for getting us out of the Paris Accord. You helped President Trump get the United States out of the Paris Accord. Would you count that as your greatest achievement as head of EPA?
I believe so. Look, I mean, we tackled some of the most challenging issues the first 2 years of the Trump administration. I was President Trump's point person. I was his guy to get things done on some of the most transformative issues in the administration the first 2 years. And I think that, from exiting the Paris Accord to, ending the weaponization against all forms of producers in the U.S. economy, from agriculture to manufacturing to most acutely the energy sector. So, yeah, I think exiting the Paris Accord, Hugh, was a tremendously important decision to the world. It was something that said that we weren't going to be taken advantage of. We were leading the world in carbon reduction when we entered the Paris Accord. We were front-loading costs while China and India, took no obligations until the year 2030. At the same time they were, committing to the Paris Accord, China and India, they were building infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure. So it was clear that the rest of the world looked at that decision by the Obama administration to enter the Paris Accord as, economically disadvantageous to the U.S. and economically advantageous to the rest of the world. And that's the reason they applauded it. And it had nothing to do with carbon reduction. So, the president made the right decision. It was a historical time for me to be with them in the Rose Garden to announce that to the world. And it was just one aspect of changing the direction of an agency that was, obviously a bastion of the American left, used as a tool and a weapon against all forms of producers in the U.S. to turn it from that to a place that was about stewardship and about respecting, our partners in the marketplace to achieve, good outcomes for the environment while also producing needed energy for the world was a tremendously important time.
Scott Pruitt, when you were at EPA, you did so many things. You took a lot of bullets for the president in terms of going after the 404 regulation to allow people to use their own land. You were out there in front on so many issues, including the Obama overreach on all forms of energy. Do the people of Oklahoma recall that as you throw your hat in the ring for the Senate seat?
Just last night I was in Oklahoma City at the Cowboy Hall of Fame at an event, it was wonderful to hear back from Oklahomans. One of the appreciation they had for President Trump's leadership, the courageous leadership, the leadership of taking on the regulatory infrastructure of Washington, D.C., not just in the EPA, but we did it across, as the entire administration. So, yes, I think they see it, particularly right now, because, when I left the administration in 2018, we were energy independent, environmental outcomes had improved, And now, just a short time later, we're energy dependent and relied upon our foes to supply the needed energy for our citizens and our economy. I mean, we've gone backwards, and it's getting worse. And you know this acutely. You know this very well. This isn't just an issue for America. This is an issue for the world. I mean, energy and currency are tools that are used, as you know, in weapons and geopolitical politics. And what's happened, I've spent a great deal of time the last 3 or 4 years in areas of the world, Bulgaria, Sofia, Romania, Bucharest, Czech Republic, and other places with respect to American energy exports. And I can tell you, just 3 or 4 years ago, after I left the administration, being in those places, they were thirsty and hungry for American energy because they did not want to be reliant upon Russia. And we couldn't get them the energy, Hugh. We could not.
I'm going to talk to your former cabinet colleague, Mike Pompeo, about that at the bottom of the hour. But I'm interested in a political thing about muscle memory. You know, I went on a bike in Paris a couple of days ago. No one forgets how to ride a bike. Do you remember how to campaign for office? You ran and won twice statewide in Oklahoma. You ran as a state senator in Oklahoma at least twice, I think. Do retail political skills come back to you after you've been away for 6 years?
Well, I pray so. I mean, I think you, it's, you know, look, I think the most important thing in running for office is being authentic, you know, being authentically who you are. And you know, I've always believed in this grand vision of this country, that we are different, that we are unique on the world stage. You know, the people of this country don't exist to serve the government exists to serve us. And candidly, you know, when you look at Washington, D.C. today, it's a place where things aren't, you know, what they should be. The U.S. Senate, in the constitutional framework view, and you know this very well, was not intended just to be another body in the legislative, you know, section of government. It was, U.S. Senate was supposed to operate differently than the U.S. House. It was a place where adults and statesmen went to look at the long view of the republic, to not do what was most expedient or most populist, but to do what was right for the preservation of the republic long term, to make the tough decisions. And you know, I was glad to be a part of President Trump's cabinet where we did exactly that. We made the tough decisions. We took on the infrastructure, the regulatory state. We achieved good outcomes, both for our citizens and the country, but also obviously in my case, the environmental outcomes as well. So it was a commitment of change. And being President Trump's point on some of his most transformative areas was something that I count a great privilege, and I think it's will resonate well, you know, in this race. And, you know, obviously I seek to offer that as I enter the race.
Hi, General Pruitt. Hi, this is Ed Morrissey. Great to be speaking with you this morning. You know, I got a chance over the years to get to know Senator James Inhofe just a little bit, right? One of the grand gentlemen of the Senate, somebody who's I believe is beloved by Oklahomans. You're going to have a difficult time filling his shoes, right? Or anybody's, not you, but everybody, anybody who comes in there is going to have a difficult time filling his shoes. What to sort of give you that sense of having the best opportunity for continuity and then growth, of course, from James Inhofe's legacy.
Well, two things. I mean, Senator Inhofe was so important and helpful to me in my confirmation process. Along with others, and I appreciate. I spent a lot of time with him during that process, and so it was something. I had known him well before, but got to know him very, very well during that process, and I'm thankful for his leadership over the many, many decades he served. But I think also going forward, Ed, you know, James Lankford's a good friend. You know, James is someone that we're like-minded, we're aligned, and I think in a state, when you have two, you're in a body. You want to work together in a way that's cohesive and emphasize respective strengths. I mean, as Attorney General, I mean, as you indicated earlier, I mean, I think the judicial confirmation process, you know, in some of the federalism issues between the U.S. government and the state in regulatory policy in all forms, you know, is something that I will know very, very well because of my previous, you know, service. And James Lankford, you know, has his strengths that complement those. And so, you know, that's the way you work together in respect in states. And look, I mean, I think the U.S. Senate needs to be a place, you know, where we go and tackle these tough issues and show the kind of courage, you know, and conviction, but also civility. You know, those things all matter. And you know, our enemies today, Ed, in my view, they look at us and they question whether we can govern ourselves anymore. And the degree of the manners of our politics right now are so divisive that they believe that we cannot. and they are and they're taking the long view, and that's why you see the kind of aggression that you see in various places of the world, China being more aggressive and obviously Russia presently. And they don't believe that we are able to lead and to be cohesive and to be about the American vision as we have in the past. That has to change.
I'm calling you Senator Pruitt already. General Pruitt, this is a sprint. I've got a friend in there with Alex Gray and other people are running, but you've got the advantage of name ID and people know you in Oklahoma. They love you in Oklahoma. What is your website? What is your Twitter handle? Where do people find you to help you out?
Look, scottforoklahoma.com is a place where people can go to join the movement. And when I say movement, you know, there are two things that I think are most desperately needed. One is restoring America's presence on the stage with respect to what we're energy dependent today. We need to become energy independent again, but more than that, you dominant. When I left the administration, and President Trump always talked about this, it's not just a matter of energy independence, it's energy dominance, because to the degree that America is producing the world's energy, environmental outcomes are better and the world is safer. So we've got to get back to that point. And then secondly, we've got to restore our ability, particularly in the U.S. Senate, to be a place where the tough decisions are made. We lead and we show the world that we can do it and that liberty and freedom still is absolutely dominant in this country. We've got to get back to that place.
Scott for Oklahoma.
ScottforOklahoma.com.
We will be back and talk to you again when I'm back stateside. General Scott Pruitt, former Attorney General of Oklahoma, now candidate for Senate in Oklahoma, former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. ScottforOklahoma.com. If you want to push back, oh, boy, you need to push back with Scott. ScottforOklahoma.com. Good to talk to you, General. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back from Paris. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt from what we call aggrandizement number two in Paris with radio blogger Ed Morrissey standing by in Texas, joined by Tarzana Joe, the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Hugh. And in honor of you and Duane's excellent vacation, the title of this week's poem is Fait Accompli. However, I will not be delivering it in a French accent.
Oh, too bad.
If you're driving toward a precipice or speeding toward a wall, you would try to slow your progress. You should try to break your fall. When you plant the seed selected in a field and nothing grows, it should lead you to consider, guess I shouldn't have planted those. When your house is on the market, but no one will pay the price, fixing broken windows and a paint job might be nice. His fastball and his slider may have made you a believer, but the score is 10 to nothing, so you call for a reliever. I give you these examples not to be obtuse or arty, but to comprehend the thinking of the Democratic Party. Huh. For they're speeding toward disaster if you listen to the news, but there's been no fine adjustment to their policies or views. Taxing new and spending hasn't really worked before. If they get elected, they just promise to do more. Higher oil prices are a platform for inflation, so shutting down the pipelines is their gift to our great nation. Not the slightest waver in their platform's been detected. How could they be running and appear so unaffected? Now, I'm certain all elections are legit and on the level, but they're running like a party with a contract with the devil. That's Fait Accompli by Tarzana Joe.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live from Paris. Radio blogger is with me, Duane, and in Texas, Ed Morrissey is standing by, should we crash and burn. I'm joined by former Secretary of State, former head of the CIA, former member of the House of Representatives, now the president of CavPAC.com, Secretary Mike Pompeo. Mr. Pompeo, welcome back. Good to talk to you, Mr. Secretary.
Hugh, it's great to be with you this morning. Hope you're having a great time in France.
We've actually had a gorgeous week. I know when you're the Secretary of State, you really don't get to enjoy the cities you visit, do you?
No, not much. It's mostly work, but it's always great to be there representing America wherever you're traveling.
Well, I want to get to the Russia war in a second, but first, I saw yesterday, even in my remove in Paris, that you have endorsed David McCormick, probably in a decisive move in the Pennsylvania Senate race. And David's been on the show a lot. I stay neutral in these. Why did Mike Pompeo say we're going in with David McCormick?
In every race I've supported someone out of CavPAC, Hugh, it's been because I thought they'd be the best leader for America. In this case, I'm confident that's Dave. He'll be great for the people of Pennsylvania, too. He's really battle-tested. He's been through so much, right? I knew him almost 40 years ago when we were cadets at West Point. He was a year behind me. So I've known him a long time. I know his color. I know his character. I I know the nature of who he is. I know how hard he'll work and what a leader he'll become. Those are the reasons I want to get out there, help Dave. I think he'll be great for the people of Pennsylvania, and I know that he'll serve America in a way that will make every one of us proud.
That makes a lot of sense. I did not know you were close to each other at West Point. That tells me a lot. I thought you were a tank guy, weren't you, Mr. Secretary? And he's an airborne, so I didn't know that the
I was a tank guy. He was an 82nd airborne guy, but you know we needed them, and they really needed us.
Okay, let me go to the very darkest story: 9,000 bodies, mass grave outside of Mariupol. What is your advice to the Biden administration about what to do about this, other than confirm it and tell us about it?
Well, those are both very important. It is horrific to see what's taking place in places like Bucha and Mariupol and all across Ukraine. The horrific pictures that we know to be true are so deeply disturbing. It's why deterrence matters. It's why you needed to stop this thing before it ever took place. Today the mission set is to continue to do everything you can to highlight these atrocities so the world can see what's really taking place, so disinformation doesn't flood the space from the Russians. Second, provide the tools that the Ukrainians ask for. You know, this is something we've talked about a couple weeks back. We've been slow and late and small in delivery of those weapon systems, and importantly, the intelligence support that they need to actually be in the right place at the right time with the right weapon system. We could do it. We have the capability to do it, and it is not only a moral imperative, but as I think we can all see now, it really matters to the United States. What happens in Kyiv doesn't stay there. It comes to our shores. Our food, lots of things are going to be more expensive, more difficult to come by as a result of the instability now, not only in Ukraine, but throughout Europe.
Ed Morrissey.
Secretary, I want to ask you about the lesson that we are getting now about the United Nations and multilateral organizations, including NATO, right? Because I think NATO has been actually performing pretty well in this crisis, but the United Nations is standing by while a genocide is taking place. They're standing by with the genocide in China as well. Whereas NATO, which is a little bit more aligned to a specific vision and a specific type of governance, seems to be more focused, more ascendant, and more responsive to these atrocities. Is this really the end of the United Nations as any sort of moral force? And frankly, has it ever really served in that capacity?
Ed, this is a really important conversation. The Trump administration was accused of not liking these multilateral organizations. The truth is, it wasn't about liking them or not liking them. It was about, are they fit for purpose? Do they serve the intended mission statement for which they were brought together? Are we just wasting our energy, time, and money, and frankly, fooling ourselves and people all across the world? I think the UN, for a long time, has been an organization incapable of actually dealing with the things it's been tasked to deal with. I saw it on the China issue, right? When you can't call out the Chinese Communist Party for what's taking place there, or when the Wuhan virus is unleashed from the world from that place, and the Secretary General of the UN says, you know, I'm not going to get involved in this. I think it's just fundamentally broken, and we've seen that here too. We've seen dozens of nations abstain from deciding which side of this fight to be on at the UN, and then even the UN Security Council itself, right? Russia, a member, China, a member. Even the Security Council itself has demonstrated its inability to deal with what is fundamentally a problem that looks and feels a lot like the very reason it was created, right? It followed from World War II. We now have the Russia attacking a European nation. It is broken, and I think our continued involvement there ought to be reconsidered in a very, very serious way. We got out of the UN Human Rights Council. I think now our money going there is really questionable, Ed.
Secretary Pompeo, you have the advantage of everyone over everyone else talking about the war, of having actually dealt with Putin, dealt a lot with Lavrov, their foreign minister. You've dealt with Macron. You've dealt, I think, with the German foreign minister, who I think was the foreign minister under Angela Merkel. As you assess everybody doing what they're doing, who has surprised you, who has disappointed you, and what changes have you seen in the 2 years since you left Foggy Bottom, less than 2 years, in the various actors on the world stage with whom you were in daily contact?
You know, I highlight too, Hugh, I think we got to give President Zelensky an enormous amount of credit. Right, we had President Ghani faced with a similar situation, cut and ran, and the political apparatus and the military fell. Zelensky said, nope, don't give me weapons. or don't give me a ride out of the country, give me weapons, and he has held that team together in a way that I think many would not have predicted. A second, I'd want to talk about Chancellor Schultz. He was, in fact, the Treasury Minister, the Finance Minister, when I was a Secretary of State. I dealt with him a fair amount on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline issue, trying to convince him that this day would come, that the Russians would use energy against the Ukrainians, against the Germans, in a way that would harm the people of Germany. Pushed and shoved, he's now gotten to a better place. I hope that when this moment, when this crisis passes, when the peak of this moment passes, that Chancellor Schultz will come to understand that windmills and sunshine are fun and interesting, but they're not going to do the things we need to do to keep our people safe. They need to get an energy policy that makes sense, and it needs to be supported by an American energy policy that helps them get to the right place. We can deliver them the natural gas and fuel that they need. I hope that the Greens and Schultz inside of Germany will come to see that and build on it in the years ahead.
Secretary Pompeo, Vladimir Putin has been hinting at the use of nuclear weapons. He's been rattling that cage now for several weeks based on the fact that it looks like he's facing humiliation in a large part of Ukraine. There's a lot of warnings about that. President Trump's national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, wrote a really interesting piece in The Wall Street Journal about what the American response should be in this case, preemptively as well as potentially post-use. What is your perspective on how best to deter Vladimir Putin from unleashing tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine?
The most important thing we can do is, and one of the things that Ambassador O'Brien highlighted, was that we have to be very clear about the things that we will do, and we need to make damn sure that we are actually prepared to do the things we tell Vladimir Putin that we're going to do.
Right.
So that clarity, that transparency, that communication is absolutely central, so that Vladimir Putin can put that into his thought process and his cost-benefit analysis when he's considering whether that's something he actually wants to do, if it's in his best interest. This is the cold-hearted, thuggish Vladimir Putin that will do simple math to decide if what makes sense for him. And so Ambassador O'Brien proposed a number of things, not all of which were in Europe, right? He talked about things we could do to the Russians where we're side-by-side with them in the Middle East and Syria. There are many tools that are at our disposal. The Biden administration should work, develop a plan, a strategy, and then we should clearly communicate that to Vladimir Putin directly, so that he knows what the American response will be. And if he should make such a mistake, if he should do something so dangerous, so abhorrent as to use a tactical nuclear weapon against civilian populations or against the military in Ukraine, we should execute the plan that we told him we were going to execute, jot and tittle, and immediately. No discussion, no meetings of the National Security Council. Decision made, execution mode.
Boy, I hope Tony Blinken hears that, Mr. Secretary. Let me move to another part of the world. In Shanghai, 25 million people are starving. And if anyone doubted, and you never did, the ruthlessness of President Xi and his colleagues in the CCP, it's on full display now. Do you think they may be facing the condition? I'm in France, where a lack of food led to the 1789 revolution. And we saw lack of food in Russia in 1918 lead to revolution. Do you think China is dancing on the edge of a cliff here with what they're doing in Shanghai?
Well, Xi bragged about his COVID policy after having unleashed the virus on millions of people from the Wuhan lab all across the world. And now he's got a real political problem and a food problem inside of his own country because of what is a crazy zero COVID objective. It's different than France. There's a lot more political control. The surveillance state is more powerful. They're willing to use force, significant force, against their own people. I suppose there could be protests, but my guess is that Xi is prepared to unleash the power of the domestic surveillance services against anyone who steps out of line. And it could look something more like what we saw in Tiananmen Square than something like you saw in Paris, France. The power of the state there is enormous, and I know that Xi will make sure that he doesn't have that bad day that you're talking about.
With that in mind, Secretary Pompeo, there's a report out this morning that Republicans are looking to dial back some of the tariffs on China. One of the hallmarks of the Trump administration was its get tough policy with China. Presumably, I would suppose that they're trying to do this as a way to ease inflation. But is this really the time to take the pressure off of China?
this is most certainly not the time. I've seen that reporting too. Look, it could be that there's a tariff or two that's in the wrong place at the wrong spot. I suppose that's possible. I don't know exactly what they're thinking about. But if the idea is to either reduce inflation at home, that's silly. It won't accomplish the mission set. There's no way that what they're contemplating can solve the problems that have been created by the Fed and now by terrible policies here domestically by the Biden administration. They're not going to solve the inflation problem with this. And second, the timing is really terrible to send a message to Xi Jinping, who has clearly sided with Vladimir Putin, and to create more wealth for Xi Jinping that he can ultimately provide and provide support and underwrite Vladimir Putin in this war. The timing would be terrible. The messaging would be terrible. And what Xi Jinping would come to understand about American leadership would put Taiwan and the rest of the Southeast Asian region at real risk as well, Ed.
Last question, Mr. Secretary. The Republican National Committee, led by Ron McDaniel, said we're not doing the Commission on Presidential Debates. That might have real world implications for you within the year if you decide to seek the presidency. What did you make of the RNC's decision? I think the Commission on Presidential Debates probably will try and put it on CNN Plus. But what does Mike Pompeo think about?
Yes, exactly. Or maybe on Disney. Look. I think in the end, Hugh, this was the right decision. The commission had lost its way. I've seen the debates these last two or three cycles. Save for Hugh Hewitt getting candidates on stage, I haven't seen a good moderator that was straight up asking serious questions. These are important times, serious times, Hugh. We ought to hold debates that are serious and thoughtful, give the candidates a chance to say the things that they intend to do so that we can hold them accountable when the time comes. The Commission on Presidential Debates said, not been able to deliver that, and I think it'll be great to find campaigns and candidates that can now make good decisions about how to present the issues to the American people in a way that will actually reflect well on our country and have a really good competitive campaign as well.
Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, thanks for joining Ed Morrissey and me this morning. I appreciate it greatly. Hang in there. Keep going with CavPack.com. America, if you want to support great candidates, go to CavPack.com and support Mike Pompeo. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt from Paris, France, with Generalissimo. Ed Morrissey is in Texas, standing by as we head into hour number three of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Deborah Flora joins us. She is one of the producers of the new SalemNow.com movie, Whose Children Are They? Deborah, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hugh. Thank you so much for having us on the show. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Obviously, Whose Children Are They is very relevant given the debate in Florida. Tell us what Whose Children Are They is about and where people can see it, how long it is, and what the message is.
You got it. Absolutely. Well, we made Whose Children Are They because we needed to put together a comprehensive expose of what is going on in schools, because parents will hear something, you know, maybe a story one area about CRT or another story about gender fluidity in kindergarten, or maybe, you know, exploitative sex education in another area. But we want to put together a comprehensive expose so they can see it all together, realize it's connected, and what they can do about it. So we spent 2 years, over 120 hours of footage, over 80 interviews, parents, teachers, frontline experts, and students speaking up. And most of all, it's what they can do about it. And they can go to whosechildrenarethey.com to learn more. It is showing now on Salem Now. And our hope is that everyone sees it and this really galvanizes people to make a change.
Deborah, this is Ed Morrissey, and I think that this is coming at it just the right time. I think parents have been asleep maybe for a couple of decades on how curriculum has shifted in schools out of their control and into the control of elites that don't have their children's best interests in mind, or at least as viewed by their parents. The last 2 years, though, of having closed schools and then remote learning have given parents, I think, a really unique window into what's actually been happening in schools. Do you sense that as well? Is that what you sense is partly behind this, is the fact that parents have kind of woken up as a result of being able to look into the classroom where they weren't able to do that before?
Oh, absolutely, Ed. Yeah, the silver lining of COVID, if there is one, is that parents got to see. I mean, most parents are very busy, sometimes working two jobs. They're, you know, running around. They just didn't have a chance. And most people presumed that the education was the kind of education they grew up with. I started seeing this when I started Parents United America about 3 years ago with the sex ed that was not age appropriate and very explicit. In fact, by the way, part of our movie, if it was rated, would be rated R, and it's simply what they're showing kids. But what happened during COVID is parents got a front row seat when their kids were learning at home. And when you have a school district in Tennessee that wants parents to sign a waiver so they don't see what their kids are learning, you know something's up. Parents did end up seeing the CRT, the extreme social agenda, and it's happening exactly when academics are plummeting and indoctrination is skyrocketing. So there is an awakening, and the goal with the movie is to make sure that this movement doesn't dissipate, that it reaches that critical mass and tipping point where real change occurs.
Deborah Flora, Hugh Hewitt again. Whose Children Are They? Are available over at salemnow.com. I anticipate the left will say, because I hear it all the time, CRT is not taught in the schools. It's an academic theory taught in graduate school. To which, what does Deborah Flora and the producers of Whose Children Are They respond?
Oh, without a doubt, it's being taught, whether it's called educational equity or whatever they want to call it. I experienced it firsthand in our school district where they call it educational equity. We found a leaked training that was nothing but CRT. And by the way, in that training, they called parents dissenters and taught how to get around us so we don't know what's happening. When in that area of CRT, we interviewed a lot of parents right in Minnesota near Ground Zero where George Floyd incident happened. And these were black parents who know it's being taught in their school and are fed up because they do not want their children taught. They are victims and oppressed just because they have let more melanin in their skin. So it's happening. Parents need to be aware. And it doesn't matter what they call it. It's not a separate course, but it's a filter through which they teach so much in their kids' education.
Ed, go ahead.
Minnesota is a great place to do this. I wrote about this 13 years ago. The University of Minnesota's education department required their students to declare their privilege. They had to basically sign that they were privileged and that they had to demonstrate that through their coursework and through their later profession work. This is not something that's new. This is something that's been really embedded into education programs for probably a couple of decades at least, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's been coming for quite a while, and we did film all over America, but we wanted to film that portion right there in Minnesota. And parents were talking about how there is this move to eliminate honors classes and AP classes because of racial profiling, saying, oh, there weren't enough of this race in this class, so we're going to eliminate it entirely. What it's really saying is, oh, if you have more melanin in your skin, you're unable to achieve, which is by definition racist. It's been going on for quite a long time, and that's what we set up in the movie all the way back to John Dewey, the father of modern education, who really actually was a communist and liked the Soviet style of school. That infiltrated very early on, and it's culminating in, you know, Marx's critical theory, which is critical race theory, just with a different wrapper put on it.
Deborah Flora, thank you so much for joining us. Whose Children Are They? Available at salemnow.com. Ed Morrissey, thank you. I'm going to go talk with Larry Arnn from Hillsdale College next. I want to remind everyone out there, Job Creators Network is a great sponsor of this show. They have a great new website up right now. You go over to Job Creators Network to find it, but you've got to go and be involved in stopping this tax bill before it gets going. The tax bill is a nightmare. Job Creators Network is out there trying to stop it very, very, very quickly, and it's got to be soon. So head over to the website at thegreatopportunityproject.com.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.